It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, the one thing we can pretty much all agree we want. Happiness.
Well, of course.
This is Dan Gilbert, happiness expert.
If you write a book with the word happiness in the title, you get one question over and over.
And the question he gets?
Hey, Doc, what's the secret of happiness?
Yeah. So what is it? It might seem crazy
what I'm about to say. Well, the first thing is, rather than answering the question, let's just think about it for a moment. Is there really a possibility, A, that it's a secret and only I know it, and you don't? And B, that it's a secret at all?
Sadly, this is true, because if there is one thing we learned from working on today's show, it's that there is no secret to happiness. But there are plenty of ideas about it, all of which we'll explore this hour. Ideas from science, design, philosophy, and the thing is, a lot of these ideas are surprisingly simple.
But you know, when people ask about the secret of happiness, and you tell them, well, take more time in your social relationships, worry less about things and more about experiences, and they kind of nod and look at you and say, yeah, but what about the secret? Because the secret of happiness is like the secret of dieting. There's no secret.
Pharrell, are you there?
Yes, sir.
So this is your song, man. I mean, happy. This is climbing the charts around the world, so I'm thinking, like, you must have the secret.
Okay.
I mean, no, seriously.
Well, you know what? Look, I'm not a guy who's walking around, like, smiling every day. we all have our ups and downs and our lefts and our rights and our diagonal, you know, but really, you know, much more simple way to look at it is to remember that you deserve to be happy. It's a natural born right.
Fair enough. All right, Pharrell, we're going to listen to the rest of the show, and I will meet you on the other side, okay?
Yes, sir.
And by the way, you have to check out the video to this song. It will literally make you happy. Later in the show, Dan Gilbert will be back to explain why we are all actually hardwired to be happy. But first, could the key to happiness be through science?
Most of what we know about happiness is, you know, what a scientist might call correlational research.
Matt Killingsworth is a scientist
who studies the causes and nature of human happiness.
Like, why are we happy at particular moments and unhappy at other ones? Well, to study that question, you've got to ask lots of people how they're feeling.
We can look at to what extent are richer people happier, are people with children happier, are unemployed people less happy, etc. But it's hard to know for sure what's causing what, and it's even harder to know what can people actually change and have an impact in their lives.
You know, like when someone asks you, how was your week? I mean, you don't think about specific things throughout your week that might have made you happy or not. And why?
The kinds of happiness that you feel when you are interacting with your kids might be very different than the kind of happiness you experience when you're eating a great dinner.
And scientists obviously can't be with you all the time to know the difference. So about 5 years ago, Matt Killingsworth came up with an idea to solve this fundamental problem of happiness research. Your smartphone, or specifically an app on your smartphone.
And the basic idea behind this is that we can now use technology to measure happiness in real time.
So here's how it works. You go to trackyourhappiness.org. You punch in your phone number, and then later, when you're, say, on the subway, you get a text.
And the idea is that you want to respond as fast as you can and tell me about your experience at the instant right before you got that text message.
And suddenly, it's like a therapist in your iPhone with some questions.
First question. How do you feel right now?
And on a sliding scale, from very good to very bad, you could say, you know, about in the middle.
Next question. Do you have to do what you're doing? Yes or no?
And you're like, yep, definitely yes. And then the questions get more detailed.
To what extent are you being productive? What time did you go to sleep last night? When did you finish eating your most recent meal today?
And then finally,
last question. Do you want to do what you're doing? Yes or no?
And here's the moment where you think, maybe I'm not. Maybe this isn't what I want to be doing right now.
I find myself and a lot of people tell me that you become much more aware of how happy you are, of how you spend your time, of, you know, a lot of the dimensions that we measure, like, you know, whether you want to be doing what you're doing.
Anyway, more on that later. But the point is, several times a day, Matt sends these texts to thousands of people.
Maybe 35,000 people who've done it.
Wherever they are.
At home, or at work, or in a vehicle, in a coffee shop.
Basically, anywhere people find themselves, Matt wants to be measuring
their happiness and details of what they're doing at that moment.
And all this adds up to a kind of statistical survey of happiness data. Because what Matt is doing, he's vacuuming up all kinds of information that no one else has ever really analyzed before. And he looks for patterns.
I can look across all of these dimensions of our lives, who we spend our time with, how we think about ourselves and other people, how well we sleep, how much we exercise. I mean, a tremendous number of variables.
Variables that might be starting to add up
over time into an equation for happiness.
And whether there is such a thing, that's a debate Matt took on in his TED Talk.
Well, since I'm a scientist, I'd like to try to resolve this debate with some data. And in particular, I'd like to present some data to you from three questions that I ask with Track Your Happiness. Remember, this is from sort of moment-to-moment experience in people's real lives. The three questions. The first one is a happiness question. How do you feel on a scale ranging from very bad to very good? Second, an activity question. What are you doing on a list of 22 different activities, including things like eating and working and watching TV? And finally, a mind-wandering question. Are you thinking about something other than what you're currently doing? People could say no. In other words, I'm focused only on my task. Or, yes, I am thinking about something else, and the topic of those thoughts are pleasant, neutral, or unpleasant. Any of those yes responses are what we called mind-wandering. So what did we find? As it turns out, people are substantially less happy when their minds are wandering than when they're not. Now, you might look at this result and say, okay, sure, on average, people are less happy when they're mind-wandering, but surely when their minds are straying away from something that wasn't very enjoyable to begin with, at least then mind-wandering should be doing something good for us. Nope. As it turns out, people are less happy when they're mind-wandering no matter what they're doing. For example, people don't really like commuting to work very much. It's one of their least enjoyable activities. And yet, they are substantially happier when they're focused only on their commute than when their mind is going off to something else. It's amazing. So how could this be happening? I think part of the reason, a big part of the reason, is that when our minds wander, we often think about unpleasant things. And they are enormously less happy when they do that. Our worries, our anxieties, our regrets. 47% of the time, people are thinking about something other than what they're currently doing, ranging from a high of 65% when people are taking a shower or brushing their teeth, to 50% when they're working, to 40% when they're exercising, all the way down to this one short bar on the right that I think some of you are probably laughing at. 10% of the time, people's minds are wandering when they're having sex. But there's something I think that's quite interesting in this graph, and that is, basically, with one exception, no matter what people are doing, they're mind-wandering at least 30% of the time, which suggests, I think, that mind-wandering isn't just frequent, it's ubiquitous. It pervades basically everything that we do. In other words, mind-wandering very likely seems to be an actual cause and not merely a consequence of unhappiness.
And that's the single biggest determinant. Like, you can say, without question, the most consistent result we have is that when your mind wanders, you're less happy.
Exactly. I think our ability to mind wander is kind of a superpower. The ability for human beings to think about something other than what they're doing allows them to plan and reason and do a lot of really amazing things that make us, you know, such a successful species. But it's a superpower we can't really control in the sense that we use it really often for things that aren't very helpful for us. And that's one of the surprising results in my research is that when I look across all the different activities that people engage in, they are universally happier when they're fully engaged in that activity and not mind wandering, no matter what they're doing.
So when they're in the moment.
When they're in the moment, exactly.
How do you do that? Like, how do you get to that place?
That's the million-dollar question, and I don't know the answer. I think it is possible for people to redirect their attention. One thing I've certainly started doing since I began this research is notice where my attention is, and when I do find it straying, especially if I'm mind-wandering about something that's not really productive or useful or adding to my experience, to just bring my attention back to whatever I'm doing and to do that repeatedly. And when I do that, I can not only sort of turn off mind wandering, but I think really enjoy that experience a lot more.
I mean, do you think that's like science, like what you're researching could ultimately give us a formula to find happiness?
I think it can make a lot of progress. This is a question that people have been thinking about for thousands of years. And there are some recurring answers, like treating other people like you would like to be treated. But at the same time, I think there are just a lot of debates that haven't really been resolved, and it's really hard to resolve them when it's just people talking at each other. And I think that is really the power of science, is to use the scientific method and collect data and figure out who's right. You know, in the same way that we've stood on the shoulders of our ancestors to understand a lot about medicine or the economy, I think we're at the start of a long, but I think really exciting journey to understand a lot more about the causes of happiness.
Matt Killingsworth, he's a researcher at UC San Francisco. His talk on happiness is at TED.com. And if you want those little happiness texts a couple times a day, check out trackyourhappiness.org. I got one right at the moment. I was like, are you doing something you have to be doing right now? And I was like, yes, I'm wiping my 2-year-old's butt. And then I was like, are you doing something you want to be doing? I was like, yeah, I guess I want to be wiping my 2-year-old's butt because I get to spend time with him. More on the surprisingly simple ideas behind happiness in just a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, ideas around happiness, fulfillment, and how so much of the science and philosophy is surprisingly simple. So we just heard about the science of happiness, and we'll get back to that a bit later in the show. But for the moment, we asked two TED speakers, one a writer, the other a designer, to explain their ideas about what makes us feel happier. Let's start with the writer.
My name is Carl Honoré, and I am an author and a speaker. I travel around the world telling everyone why it makes sense to slow down.
Yeah, it does make sense to slow down, but I read you play hockey.
I'm not quite as fast as I used to when I was 16, but I'm still playing.
Wow, because I was thinking like Tai Chi. Tai Chi, like competitive Tai Chi maybe?
I'm not good enough to be competitive, I'm afraid.
So Carl Honoré says we are a world obsessed with speed, and our need to do everything faster, to cram more and more into less and less time, it's not making us any happier. Here's Carl on the TED stage.
We're so marinated in the culture of speed that we almost fail to notice the toll it takes on every aspect of our lives, on our health, our work, our relationships, and our community. And sometimes it takes a wake-up call, doesn't it, to alert us to the fact that we're hurrying through our lives instead of actually living them, that we're living the fast life instead of the good life. My wake-up call came when I started reading bedtime stories to my son. And I found that at the end of the day, I would go into his room, and I just couldn't slow down. You know, I'd be speed reading The Cat in the Hat. You know, I'd be skipping lines here, paragraphs there, sometimes a whole page. And of course, my little boy knew the book inside out. So we would quarrel. And what should have been the most relaxing, the most intimate, the most tender moment of the day when a dad sits down to read to his son became instead this kind of gladiatorial battle of wills, a clash between my speed and his slowness. And this went on for some time until I caught myself scanning a newspaper article with time-saving tips for fast people, and one of them made reference to a series of books called The 1-Minute Bedtime Story. And I wince saying those words now, but my first reflex was to say, Hallelujah. Yeah. What a great idea. This is exactly what I'm looking for to speed up bedtime even more. But thankfully, a light bulb went on over my head, and my next reaction was very different. And I took a step back, and I thought, whoa, you know, has it really come to this? Am I really in such a hurry that I'm prepared to fob off my son with a soundbite at the end of the day? But why is it so hard to slow down? I think there are various reasons. One is that the speed is fun. You know, speed is sexy. It's all that adrenaline rush. It's hard to give it up. Another reason, though, I think perhaps even the most powerful reason why we find it hard to slow down is the cultural taboo against slowing down. The slow is a dirty word in our culture. It's a byword for lazy, slacker, for being somebody who gives up. You know, he's a bit slow. It's actually synonymous with being stupid. I think there's a kind of metaphysical dimension that speed becomes a way of walling ourselves off from the bigger, deeper questions. We fill our heads with distraction, with busyness, so that we don't have to ask, am I well? Am I happy? Are my children growing up right?
See, like, I have so been there. You know, it's like when you wake up at like 3 in the morning and everything slows down, and that's actually when I start to feel anxious, like I'm definitely not happy.
That's true. I think that's probably a very common experience. But do you not find also that you stick with that and sometimes you work something out or you come to terms with something that you had maybe just been putting on the back burner? Do you never find any kind of benefit from falling through that anxiety or those late night palpitations and worries?
No, I usually just take an Ambien.
Back to the quick fix again.
I still love speed. You know, I live in London and I work as a journalist and I enjoy the buzz and the busyness and the adrenaline rush that comes from both of those things. But I've also got in touch with my inner tortoise. I no longer overload myself gratuitously. And the upshot of all of that is that I actually feel a lot happier, healthier, more productive than I ever have. I feel like I'm living my life rather than actually just racing through it. So is it possible? That's really the main question before us today. Is it possible to slow down? And I'm happy to be able to say to you that the answer is a resounding yes.
Carl Honoré, his TED Talk is called In Praise of Slowness. Check it out at ted.npr.org. Okay, so if that sounds, you know, kind of simple, it's because there might be something to the relationship between simplicity and happiness. At least that's what the designer Graham Hill would argue. And back in the day, he was on the web before it was really the web.
We were very fortunate. So
we're talking 94, 95.
This was at a time where people confused their email addresses and their website addresses.
Okay, so the 10-second version of the story is that Graham and some friends built a company designing websites. And then a couple years later, they sold it for about $10 million. Graham was barely 30, never dreamed he would see that kind of money.
No, I came from like a middle-class sort of family, and so, yeah.
So you're 28, you've got all this money, and the natural thing to do is buy a lot of
Yeah, it's like there's this void all of a sudden that you have to fill. And I mean, I didn't go that crazy, but it was a lot of stuff. So I bought... Yeah, I bought a 3,600 square foot home, stuff. Volvo sedan, tons of furniture, stuff. Gizmos, technology, stereos, stuff. Probably had one of the first MP3 players. Stuff. You can't believe how much stuff. It was cool to have a nice car, stuff. But are you buying the right thing? Stuff. Is it the right price? Yeah, and then so just thinking about it, sort of like feel like a pit in my stomach, just stuff. Having this house and just realizing you got to fill it full of stuff. I mean, listen, I have zero complaints. I've been extremely fortunate, but like making a bunch of money doesn't radically transform you into a happy person.
Actually, all that stuff started to drive him kind of nuts. So he decided to do something a lot of rich dudes don't, which is he got rid of it. And so Graham's big idea became too much stuff is making us less happy. Here he is on the TED stage.
Did you know that we Americans have about 3 times the amount of space we did 50 years ago? 3 times. So you'd think with all this extra space, we'd have plenty of room for all our stuff, right? Nope. There's a new industry in town, a $22 billion, 2.2 billion square foot industry, that of personal storage. So we've got triple the space, but we've become such good shoppers that we need even more space. So where does this lead? Lots of credit card debt, huge environmental footprints, and perhaps not coincidentally, our happiness levels flatline over the same 50 years. Well, I'm here to suggest there's a better way, that less might actually equal more. I bet most of us have experienced at some point the joys of less. College, in your dorm, traveling in a hotel room, camping where you got basically nothing, maybe a boat. Whatever it was for you, I bet that among other things, this gave you a little more freedom, a little more time.
So back in 2007, surrounded by a bunch of useless stuff that was not making him happy, Graham decided to edit his life. And he started by trying to come up with a way to live that was simpler and smaller. And so he called up some other designers and friends, and he came up with a plan for a new way to live his life. And what came out of it was a 420-square-foot apartment that is almost zen-like in its simplicity. So imagine
you wake up in the morning
in a bright room with big windows, a comfortable queen bed,
and hop out of that and you
just close it up right into the wall, which then reveals
a nice couch, and so you're basically in living room format at that point.
And the wall across from you,
you just pull out this wall and it runs on tracks that are, it's like library technology that are in the floor.
And behind that wall, two more beds
that fold down,
kind of like bunk beds.
And so you get some decent privacy, and you can have guests over, which is great.
And that's really the least of it. Everything in Graham's tiny apartment, the kitchen, bathroom, everything is designed to save space and minimize stuff.
The horizontal surfaces tend to attract stuff, and so the less you can have, the easier it is to be neat.
And instead, nearly every wall opens up to a storage space or a closet. There's a foldable table and chair seating for 10, and all of it can be stored in the walls, out of sight.
I mean, this is a 420-square-foot apartment. You have had dinner parties with 10 guests comfortably.
Yeah, and it's a lot better than it sounds. It's actually a beautiful, beautiful little room, and our point is less but better. So, you know, we're not saying no stuff. Have stuff. Just have great stuff that's really versatile and that you really love.
And right now, Graham is developing a whole apartment building based on this concept in Brazil, a community he thinks will be a really, really happy place to live.
We want space efficiency. We want things that are designed for how they're used the vast majority of the time, not that rare event. Why have a 6-burner stove when you rarely use 3? So we want things that nest, we want things that stack, and we want to digitize. You can take paperwork, books, movies, and you can make it disappear. It's magic. Finally, we want multifunctional spaces and housewares. A sink's combined with a toilet. A dining table becomes a bed. Same space. So I'm not saying that we all need to live in 420 square feet, but consider the benefits of an edited life. Go from 3,000 to 2,000, from 1,500 to 1,000. So when you go home and you walk through your front door, take a second and ask yourselves, could I do with a little life editing? Would that give me a little more freedom, maybe a little more time? So let's make room for the good stuff. Thank you.
So here's a story. My dad called me, and he said, son, you are approaching middle age, and I don't feel like I should be storing your things from your childhood anymore. There are 14 boxes in the house, and I'm putting them on a crate in L.A. and shipping them off to you in Washington. So I got them, and there was this cool stuff in there, like art things I did when I was, like, six, and, like, it's kind of cool, and there's a lot of it. There's an abundance of it.
Yeah.
But I can't, like, I kind of, it was special. It was like, I'm not going to get rid of this.
So I would say, like, how important is the physical aspect of that? And so, like, I'll have a shirt that I've worn. It's got, like, a really, there are memories attached to it. I just take a picture. Done.
Yeah, okay, but I get that. That's fine. But I'm not going to take a picture of, like, my handprint in the clay from when I was, like, 3.
Why
like
not?
That, I mean, because it's cool. I mean, my kid can hold that. This stuff makes me happy.
I'd probably, and if it was me, I'd probably keep maybe a handful of them and then take pictures of all the rest.
But how do you know you're not going to regret that one day? Like, how do you know if you don't sort of, like, over-edit your life?
Yeah, well, but think about it. You didn't even know what that stuff was necessarily.
You're right. And that's a good point.
I mean, I think as, like, a way of editing your own life, let's just remember that what really matters in life is memorable experiences, connections, and relationships, and space and stuff should support that.
Graham Hill, his company is called Life Edited. You can see really amazing pictures of his apartment at lifeedited.com and check out his talk at ted.npr.org. And speaking of tiny spaces,
right now I'm sitting in a very small room on the Harvard University campus filled with electronica.
This is Harvard psychologist Dan Gilbert again, and we brought him into that small studio to ask him about his life's work.
What really brings happiness about has become a question that we have put in the hands of poets and philosophers for millennia, and then recently we've asked scientists to answer questions about what brings human happiness.
So, like, you study the Super Bowl of scientific subjects.
Of course. Why would I write a book about something that wasn't the single most important topic in the world?
Here's the open from Dan's TED Talk.
When you have 21 minutes to speak, 2 million years seems like a really long time. But evolutionarily, 2 million years is nothing. And yet in 2 million years, the human brain has nearly tripled in mass, going from the 1.25-pound brain of our ancestor here, Habilis, to the almost 3-pound meatloaf that everybody here has between their ears. And one of the main reasons that our brain got so big is because it got a new part called the prefrontal cortex. Now, what does a prefrontal cortex do for you that should justify the entire architectural overhaul of the human skull in the blink of evolutionary time? Well, turns out the prefrontal cortex does lots of things, but one of the most important things it does is it is an experience simulator. Human beings have this marvelous adaptation that they can actually have experiences in their heads before they try them out in real life. This is a trick that got our species out of the trees and into the shopping mall. Now, all of you have done this. I mean, you know, Ben and Jerry's doesn't have liver and onion ice cream, and it's not because they whipped some up, tried it, and went yuck. It's because without leaving your armchair, you can simulate that flavor and say yuck before you make it. Research that my laboratory has been doing, that economists and psychologists around the country have been doing, have revealed something really quite startling to us. Something we call the impact bias, which is the tendency for the simulator to work badly. For the simulator to make you believe that different outcomes are more different than in fact they really are. From field studies to laboratory studies, we see that winning or losing an election, gaining or losing a romantic partner, getting or not getting a promotion, passing or not passing a college test, on, have far less impact, less intensity, and much less duration than people expect them to have. In fact, a recent study showing how major life traumas affect people suggests that if it happened over 3 months ago, with only a few exceptions, it has no impact whatsoever on your happiness.
So I'm, like, totally surprised at this idea that like, just 3 months after some kind of traumatic experience, I mean, with just few exceptions, it has no impact on happiness. I mean, I cannot imagine somebody, you know, like, ever finding real happiness again after that.
That's because your imagination, like mine, like everyone else's, is extraordinarily limited. It's not because people don't get over these events, and if by get over we mean end up having happy, productive lives, they do. In fact, the vast majority of people who experience any kind of tragedy or trauma will ultimately return to their baseline or very close to their baseline in what seems like relatively short order. We don't recognize that we are as resilient a species as we turn out to be. What's interesting to me as a psychologist is, why don't we know this about ourselves?
Yeah.
Why is this remarkable talent hidden from our view? Why are we all surprised when people who lose a child or lose a job or lose their vision a year or two later are doing pretty darn well?
Yeah. I mean, I'm right. Why?
Well, I think there might be two reasons. First, the processes that enable us to be resilient and recover are often invisible. They're things our minds are doing behind the scenes. And because we don't see our minds doing them, we don't know that we're capable of it. The other possibility that philosophers and psychologists bandy about is that it's important that we not know this about ourselves. Just imagine if you knew that losing your marriage or losing your job would eventually be okay. Would you take precautions to not let any of those things happen? Maybe we are built to be strangers to ourselves so that we do the very things that evolution would have us do.
But how did we get that way? Stay with us. More on the science of happiness with Dan Gilbert in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. So Dan Gilbert, as we just heard, studies happiness. And his big idea about it, an idea that's surprisingly simple, is that we are all actually hardwired to more or less be happy. And why is that? Here's more of Dan from the TED stage.
Because happiness can be synthesized. Sir Thomas Brown wrote in 1642, "I am the happiest man alive. I have that in me that can convert poverty to riches, adversity to prosperity. I am more invulnerable than Achilles. Fortune hath not one place to hit me." What kind of remarkable machinery does this guy have in his head? Well, it turns out it's precisely the same remarkable machinery that all of us have. Human beings have something that we might think of as a psychological immune system, a system of cognitive processes, largely non-conscious cognitive processes, that help them change their views of the world so that they can feel better about the worlds in which they find themselves. Like Sir Thomas, you have this machine. Unlike Sir Thomas, you seem not to know it.
Yeah, I mean, we really don't. If happiness can be synthesized, I mean, is it real? Like, is it real happiness?
Well, it's real. Synthetic doesn't mean not real. It means it was synthesized. The word synthetic describes the origin of something. So synthetic nylon is nylon. It's not an imaginary stocking. It's just manufactured in a laboratory. Similarly, real and synthetic are not kinds of happiness, they're sources of happiness. They tell us whether a person's happiness was generated by the events that happened to them or by their reframing of those events. Both of these are legitimate ways to achieve happiness. And the kind of happiness we achieve, as far as psychologists can tell, isn't qualitatively different.
We synthesize happiness, but we think happiness is a thing to be found. Now, you don't need me to tell you too many examples of people synthesizing happiness, I suspect, though I'm going to show you some experimental evidence as a challenge to myself, since I say this once in a while in lectures. I took a copy of the New York Times and tried to find some instances of people synthesizing happiness, and here are three guys synthesizing happiness. The first one is Jim Wright. Some of you are old enough to remember he was the chairman of the House of Representatives. And he resigned in disgrace when this young Republican named Newt Gingrich found out about a shady book deal he had done. He lost everything. He lost his money, he lost his power. What does he have to say all these years later about it? "I am so much better off physically, financially, mentally, and in almost every other way. What other way would there be to be better off? Vegetably, minerally, animally?" He's pretty much covered in there. Maurice Bickham is somebody you've never heard of. Maurice Bickham uttered these words. Upon being released, he was 78 years old. He'd spent 37 years in Louisiana State Penitentiary for a crime he didn't commit. He was ultimately exonerated at the age of 78 through DNA evidence. And what did he have to say about his experience? "I don't have 1 minute's regret. It was a glorious experience." Glorious! This guy is not saying, "Well, yeah, there's some nice guys. They had a gym." It's glorious, a word we usually reserve for something like a religious experience. Oh, and then finally, you know, the best of all possible worlds. Some of you recognize this young photo of Pete Best, who was the original drummer for the Beatles. until they, you know, kind of like sent him out on an errand and snuck away and picked up Ringo on a tour. Well, in 1994, when Pete Best was interviewed, yes, he's still a drummer, yes, he's a studio musician, he had this to say, "I'm happier than I would have been with the Beatles." Okay, there's something important to be learned from these people, and it is the secret of happiness. Here it is, finally to be revealed. First, accrue wealth, power, and prestige, then lose it. Second, spend as much of your life in prison as you possibly can. And finally, never, ever join the Beatles.
I still can't believe that Pete Best is really happier that he didn't join the Beatles, but I guess I have to believe him.
Well, not only should we trust him when he says he's happier that he didn't join the Beatles, we should really trust him when he says he's happy. And I suspect that if we could compare his happiness to the happiness that Ringo Starr experiences or Paul McCartney experiences, we wouldn't find many differences.
But what is it about these people that you mentioned? Like, what is their secret?
Some people are more capable of doing this work than others. All of us are capable of it sometimes and not capable of it at other times. But the point is, the amount of happiness or unhappiness we feel is in part in our hands. The "in part" part of that sentence is remarkably important. It is wrong to say that we have no control over our happiness. It is wrong to say that we have complete control over our happiness. We have some input into how happy we will be. And it has to do with how we frame events. We can learn to see events in a constructive and positive way.
To what extent do things like marriage or falling in love or getting a promotion or, I mean, to what extent do those things have an impact on how happy we're going to be?
They have an extremely large impact for an extremely brief amount of time.
Huh.
When you think of something like winning the lottery or falling in love or something bad like losing your eyesight or getting fired from your job, you're probably imagining the early moments of those episodes. Well, indeed, the day you get fired from your job or the day you meet the girl of your dreams are very special days. What it turns out to be the case is that the happiness that these events induce doesn't last that long.
I mean, how? What explains that?
Well, a number of things explain it. One of them is just the nature of emotion. Happiness is an emotion. It's a feeling. And the human brain isn't built to sustain a single feeling over the long term. Look, think of it this way. Your emotions are a compass. They're telling you which direction to go in. When you feel bad, you turn left. You try something different in your life. When you feel good, you keep on marching in the direction you're going. That's what emotions are for. Now, what good would a compass be if it were perpetually stuck on north? It turns out that human beings need their emotions to both be elicited, but then to come back to baseline, and happiness is one of the emotions that does exactly that.
The bard said everything best, of course, and he's making my point here, but he's making it hyperbolically. 'Tis nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so. It's nice poetry, but that can't exactly be right. Is there really nothing good or bad? Is it really the case that gallbladder surgery and a trip to Paris are just the same thing? Nah, that seems like a one-question IQ test. They can't be exactly the same. In other words, yes, some things are better than others. We should have preferences that lead us into one future over another. But when those preferences drive us too hard and too fast because we have overrated the difference between these futures, we are at risk. The lesson I want to leave you with from these data is that our longings and our worries are both to some degree overblown because we have within us the capacity to manufacture the very commodity we are constantly chasing when we choose experience. Thank you.
So I guess you're right. I mean, there really is no secret to happiness.
There is no secret. It takes work, and it isn't hard work, but it's work that you have to put in religiously over time. Somebody who spends a few minutes a day playing with their children and really being present, that's not going to make you instantly happy the day you do it. But over months and years of practice, this will change your life.
Are those some of the things that you do?
Yes, I do some of these things myself. For example, every day as I walk to work, I remind myself how grateful I am that I'm walking. A few years ago, I couldn't walk because I had a back injury that really took me out of circulation. And not a day goes by now when I put one foot in front of the other, I think, walking. This is really good.
Psychologist Dan Gilbert. His talk is called The Surprising Science of Happiness, and you can watch it at ted.npr.org. So it turns out the source of happiness might not be discovered in a Harvard lab, but in a monastery in upstate New York, where a Benedictine monk named David Steindl-Rast practices something so incredibly simple that Brother David says everyone, no matter how busy they are, has the time to do it. Take a listen to his TED Talk.
Now, my topic is gratefulness. How is the connection between happiness and gratefulness? Many people would say, well, that's very easy. When you are happy, you are grateful. But think again. Is it really the happy people that are grateful? We all know quite a number of people who have everything that it would take to be happy, and they are not happy because they want something else, or they want more of the same. And we all know people who have lots of misfortune, and they are deeply happy. They radiate happiness. We are surprised. Why? Because they are grateful. So it is not happiness that makes us grateful. It's gratefulness that makes us happy. Now, we can ask, what really do we mean by gratefulness? And how does it work? We experience something that's valuable to us. Something's given to us, and it's really given. These two things have to come together. It has to be something valuable, and it's a real gift. You haven't bought it, you haven't earned it, you haven't traded it in, you haven't worked for it, it's just given to you. Then gratefulness spontaneously rises in my heart. Happiness spontaneously rises in my heart. That's how gratefulness happens. And how can we live gratefully? By experiencing, by becoming aware that every moment is a given moment, as we say. It's a gift. You have no way of assuring that there will be another moment given to you. And yet, that's the most valuable thing that can ever be given to us. We say, opportunity knocks only once. Well, think again. Every moment is a new gift, over and over again. And if you miss the opportunity of this moment, another moment is given to us, and another moment. We can avail ourselves of this opportunity, or we can miss it. And if we avail ourselves of the opportunity, it is the key to happiness. Does that mean that we can be grateful for everything? Certainly not. We cannot be grateful for violence, for war, for oppression, for exploitation. But I didn't say we can be grateful for everything. I said we can be grateful in every given moment for the opportunity. And even when we are confronted with something that is terribly difficult, we can rise to this occasion and respond to the opportunity that is given to us. And we can rise to it by learning something, which is sometimes painful. Learning patience, for instance, that's an opportunity that is given to us. To learn, to suffer, to stand up. All these opportunities are given to us, but they are opportunities, and those who avail themselves of those opportunities are the ones that we admire. They make something out of life. And those who fail get another opportunity. we always get another opportunity. That's the wonderful richness of life. So how can we find a method that will harness this? How can each one of us find a method for living gratefully, not just once in a while being grateful, but moment by moment to be grateful? How can we do it? It's a very simple method. It's so simple that it's actually what we were told as children when we learned to cross the street. Stop, look, go. That's all. But how often do we stop? We rush through life. We don't stop. We miss the opportunity because we don't stop. We have to stop, we have to get quiet, and we have to build stop signs into our lives. When we open our hearts to the opportunities invite us to do something. Stop, look, and then go, and really do something. And what we can do is whatever life offers to you in that present moment, mostly it's the opportunity, enjoy. If we take this opportunity, go with it. And that little stop, look, go is such a potent seed that it can revolutionize our world. Because we are at the present moment in the middle of a change of consciousness. There is a wave of gratefulness because people are becoming aware how important this is and how this can change our world. It can change our world in immensely important ways. Because if you're grateful, you're not fearful. And if you're not fearful, you're not violent. If you're grateful, you act out of a sense of enough and not of a sense of scarcity, and you're willing to share. If you're grateful, you're enjoying the differences between people, and you're respectful to everybody. And that changes this power pyramid under which we live. And it doesn't make for equality, but it makes for equal respect, and that is the important thing. A grateful world is a world of joyful people. Grateful people are joyful people. And that is what I hope for us. And if this has contributed a little to making you want to do the same, stop, look, go. Thank you.
Brother David Steindl-Rast. Hey, Pharrell?
Yes, sir.
So, I'm feeling happier, you know? I mean, like, what's your thing? Like, the one thing you do to make yourself happy?
Just be appreciative. It's all in your perspective. So, I always try to remind people, like, listen, all the young creative minds out there that are listening right now, when everybody else is caught up in buying your happiness versus trying your happiness, you know? Like, if you think that your life is happy, then that you're probably going to notice the twinkles and the interesting things that are happening in your life. It's all in your perspective.
All right, cool. Hey, Pharrell, thank you.
Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Pharrell Williams, his song, This Song, no doubt the happiest one of the year. Hey, thanks for listening to our show on happiness this week. If you missed any of it, or if you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many, many more TED Talks at ted.com. You can download this show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Our intern is Rund Abdel Fattah. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.